Hi, this is Steve, and here are some more of my gaming vexes. Welcome to All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes. In this show, I document my ongoing attempts to try and run, or at very least play, all of the tabletop role-playing games that I've purchased in hard copy. I'm not counting PDF purchases, as that way madness lies. Once we've finished a series of games, I and my lovely players get together to mull over our thoughts about the rules, the setting, and anything else that takes our fancy. Although in reality, we're rarely ever actually vexed by the games we play, we do reflect on what might make our experience of the game even better, should we ever bring it back to the table. After what's become a traditional lull over the summer break, in this episode we look back on not one, but two games we've played recently. Modiphius' John Carter of Mars, using their in-house 2D20 system, and Arcana Media's Nibiru, a sci-fi game of lost memories. Think of it like a double A-side single that, when it actually got played on the Top 40 show on Sunday afternoons, was never the side you actually liked. The analogy breaks down a bit there though, as I think both of these games have a lot to offer. John Carter is a fairly straightforward proposition, in that it allows players to dive into the two-fisted planetary romances of Edgar Rice Burroughs' pulp novels, depicting Barsoom, that's Mars to you and me, and beyond. Nibiru is an altogether different prospect. The pitch on their website reads as follows. Nibiru is a science fiction tabletop role-playing game set in a massive space station in a neighbouring solar system. Players take on the role of vagabonds, people who woke up in the space station with no memories of their past. Nibiru tackles themes of memory, nature and artificiality through simple mechanics, evocative art and immersive world building. The game's rules foster creative writing and see players producing bite-sized chunks of character background to advance the story. Interesting. As always, I'm joined by my stalwart players to discuss these games. Kat, Andrew, Mark and Jim give their views on John Carter, whilst Kat returns to discuss Nibiru, accompanied by Martin and Sam. Thanks again for your time and enthusiasm, everyone. This show wouldn't happen without you. As for the future, we're about to record an episode on Cubicle 7 Soulbound, we're just wrapping up a series of Green Ronin's The Expanse, and we're in the middle of playing Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition. So there's plenty to come, but for now, get ready. So, yeah, we're going to have a bit of a chat about John Carter of Mars from Modiphius. So, first of all, as is traditional, we are introductions to everybody. So, who are you? What was your character in the game? And how high can you jump in real life? And I'll be asking for evidence.
Evening all. Jim Hawkins, I play Ketan Krell, Green Martian, Padawan of the Thark Horde, Crackshot, Ace Tracker and Scout. Not very good at sneaking, though, bizarrely, unless they were minions or moves. So, yes, that was my awesome character. And how high can you jump in real life? Like standing jump or just like standing jump?
Yeah, standing jump straight upwards. Not a distance, just straight up.
Well, so if I jump and lift my knees as well, I reckon I can get, at least 50 centimetres at least.
50? Oh, that's not bad, actually. I was going to say probably go for a metre.
I don't mean to be funny, but I'm getting on a bit. I'm not like a bounce around the house.
With the exception of Kat, we're all getting on it. Right, okay, we've got 50 centimetres to beat.
I'm Kat, I'm from Mirabir. I actually had to go get a ruler because centimetres is not something I usually work with. Because with a zine, I usually work in inches because it's easier. Roughly on a rough guess with a video propped up when I was jumping earlier.
She did it.
I think roughly about 25 centimetres, not very high at all, because I suddenly realised that I was actually more concerned with the land.
That's fair enough. I mean, we've all got knees to take care of.
I was playing Molly, the human, the Jazumian out of our group, hence why my character was bounding here, there and everywhere, like a gummy bear on steroids. I was pretty much anything where I could jump and punch, there was me.
And very effective it was too.
Mark Willoughby right on Twitter, and I played, I played the role of Durr, finest swordsman on all of Arsoom, both a name and a full description of the character. Yeah, how high can I jump? Well, it's a good question. And again, I kind of follow Jim's example, really. And I thought, well, it was less more of jumping and is how fast I can lift my feet up from the floor. Unfortunately, as soon as I lift my feet up from the floor, I start dropping. So it's not the full length of my leg. It's a bit less than that. I estimate. Well, I know two things based on my experimental data. One is that I think it's about 2 feet. And two is very painful. Very painful.
Don't do that at home, kids, because again we've got hips that can get damaged.
I'm Andrew. You can find me on various social media as Zos93. In the game I played the dashing Red Martian airship officer Tarantal. In terms of jumping, apparently about 30 centimeters, as witnessed by my wife, who would never lie about the length of anything, to be honest.
Of course. Right, okay, let's move on. We were playing John Carter Mars, which I think it's fair to say is a pulp game setup. So, I mean, I don't think I've ever run or played in a pulp game, really. So pulp is, you know, it's sort of my very brief bit of research I did for this, which is about 10 minutes before we came on the call. So pulp's something that's utterly fantastic in terms of scope and fast-paced, lots of drama, you know, lots of, you know, rough and tumble, lots of action, and not a lot of character threat, really, I don't think. So have you guys played games like that before, or is this completely new? There's a new sort of style of play?
Well, I've played pulp Call of Cthulhu. I think where it differs from normal Call of Cthulhu is that there isn't the very long character arcs and politics. It's very sort of much in the spirit of the old sort of like pulp novels that you used to possibly read when you were a teenager. It's very much, you know, he noticed there was something odd about that door. There's none of this 15 hours trying to find a secret door thing. You straight away can find it in Pulp Fiction and smash through it and get onto the threat, which I think this very much was. We didn't investigate anything, let's be honest. Oh no, everyone's had their brains scooped out. How could we have not realized this was going to happen?
And it's obvious.
Because you ran off straight into there?
Yeah, it's all good fun. Lots of action. Yeah, so you played sort of pulp games before, and is that a style of game that you enjoy generally, or is it something that you is nice as a bit of an occasional palate cleanser or a change of pace?
I think palate cleanser, change of pace. I don't think I could do it all the time. Oddly enough, I played Masks with Jim running it. Okay. And Masks is slightly pulpy, but it's got a little bit more character development going on, which I would say would be more my happy medium between that and this. This was fun, but it's not that I could do week in, week out, if that makes sense. It would drive me nuts after a while.
Yeah, it's got a certain... I mean, we played about 13 sessions of this, so it's fairly... a reasonable amount of time playing with him, but yeah.
I've played Pulp Cthulhu. We're currently playing Mars of Nihilathotep using the Pulp Cthulhu rules, which I would say aren't as pulpy as the John Carter rules, you know, and in terms of the Pulp Cthulhu, it simply means that you've got more chance of actually taking on the monsters than under sort of regular Call of Cthulhu rules. I really like pulp games because I kind of really like heroic games where you can be kind of stupidly heroic, you know, as opposed to some of the more sort of dour or political games. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great.
I mean, you've got... It's kind of two things, isn't it? Because the pulp is a setting. It's a genre. It's a genre, isn't it? You know, because it's you know, like you say, it's very kind of two-fisted and, you know, kind of breakneck speed. You know, Indiana Jones is a great example. I used to have the role-playing game, but I don't know whether that's happened to that. John Carter is pulp because it's full-on. I mean, the film, you were saying earlier, watching the film, the film pretty much is. I mean, I played way back in the day. I've still got a book somewhere. Top Secret had a Agent 13 source book. And it was like a pulpy sort of series of novels that they had. And it was really kind of leaned into that whole thing. Secret societies and, you know, two-fisted heroes, blazing Tommy guns. You know, it was the 30s, punching Nazis, all that stuff. So the system didn't really lend itself to that. But you make of it what you will, because it's more the genre. I mean, I'd argue that something like Savage Worlds is really kind of made for that kind of game, because it's breakneck speed, fast, furious and fun, you know, all that sort of stuff. But the, you know, 2D20 works okay.
I was going to make the point that Savage Worlds, a few things in Savage Worlds at cons and things, Savage Worlds is a bit flexible in terms of that. I'd make the case for Barbarians of Lemuria as a pulp game as well, sort of in a Conan-esque way. And recently twice, two different games played Hard City, which is a gangster thing, somewhat narrative, but yeah, in a pulpy style. Yeah, it was good.
Good fun. All right, okay. So
I mean, this is the first time I've played 2D20. It's certainly the first time I'd run it. I mean, I've got a couple of games on the shelf. So I've got Mutant Chronicles, which I think that's what the 2D20 system for the Modifier Time system was written for. And the rules are, from what I understand, very stripped back from other games, like Star Trek, for example. And you've already mentioned things like Savage Worlds, but what did you think of the rules themselves as they were set out for John Carter of Mars?
Well, at the risk of upsetting somebody, a particular person, I actually think 2D20 is very clever. Uh-huh. I think 2D20 as a system, and it's a strange system because it's a system that changes for every game. Mm. For everything that it's used in. Conan is different from John Carter, which is different from Star Trek, which is different from, I have played Fallout, and they're all different. And they seem to be very clever at finding a way to make it fit the style of game. You know, you can't really say there couldn't be a bigger difference between Star Trek and John Carter, and yet they both sort of fit. They both fit into the system.
So the core mechanic is always the same, isn't it, really? So you roll the own number of D20s, and it's how, you know, you add a couple of attributes together. Or, I mean, I've never played Star Trek, but it may be that skills are in there as well.
I think the skills might be a little bit lower, mm-hmm. for one thing. But even then, in the core mechanics, the over and under bit doesn't work the same way.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everything is tuned a little bit, not karma. What do we call it in
momentum, is it?
Momentum, yeah. The way the momentum pots it. In John Carter, it's shared. In Conan, in John Carter, it's individual. In Conan, it's shared. And actually, it does seem to work quite cleverly to encourage you to do, I don't know, to encourage you to play in the style that the game has been designed for. In some ways, it seems really simple and really straightforward, but I think it might actually be quite clever.
Mm, surprisingly, for game design. Well, one up for the game designers. I mean, I think, for people that haven't looked at John Carter, I mean, there's no skills in it as such. You might get a few statements. So, for example, Taran Tal was the sky captain, and he would have a statement on his sheet which says, "It can fly airships." That was it, basically. You could do it. And then for all characters, you have a set of attributes, and essentially you add a couple of them together. And once you've added a couple of them together, you end up with a sort of a total, and you roll D20s, and obviously if you get less than a total, that's a success. If you get less than whatever the lowest attribute is, then it counts as two. And that's it. You roll against a difficulty number. I just felt that for my money, the fact there were no skills in it was probably quite freeing, but on the other hand, you kept rolling the same combination of attributes over and over again for things. What were your thoughts on the system itself in terms of how it worked?
I mean, if you think about it, that's kind of Moldvay D&D, isn't it? No skills, just attribute. Mm. And like, the thief had like all the thief skills, but apart from that, that was it. Mm. If you wanted to do something, well, you just rolled the appropriate attribute. That's what he did, and that was the 70s. You know, so it's kind of going to come back around almost. You know, in a way. But I mean, I played. I played the first time I tried Star Trek. Actually, it was a Cat's game at Albert. I mean, I like Star Trek anyway, so I was all in on it, full stop. But I like the way it sort of fits the sort of Star Trek sort of vibe, where everyone is generally competent. You know, the crew are generally pretty competent, and the system sort of fits that within the Star Trek game. Yeah. There was a little bit more leeway for not succeeding perhaps as well in John Carter, but then I guess that's kind of part of it. You know, the heroes do occasionally fail or, you know, fall off a cliff, but, you know, they'll catch themselves or someone will fly in and save them and all the rest of it, because that's part
that's
of the genre, the sort of over-the-topness of it. So yeah, I haven't played Conan, but I have read it, and I do like the way Momentum is set up in that Doom and all that sort of stuff. So I quite like 2D20. It's not been my go-to, but you know, I certainly wouldn't, you know, turn my nose up at it like perhaps some people would.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I've played Star Trek, I've played Conan, I've played this. I really like the 2D20 system, and I like the way it's adapted. I mean, you talk about talents earlier, you touched on like airship pilot, but one of the things I did like was the talents were really kind of open-ended and you're encouraged to make up your own, so it's very sort of pulpy from that kind of, you know, the characters were kind of not particularly well defined, so that when it came to a moment you could come up with something appropriately kind of pulpy, and you were kind of encouraged because you don't have the skills, because, you know, the thing, obviously I play a lot of RuneQuest, you know, so if I look at something and I think I'm 25% chance, I think, oh, I'm not going to bother doing that because, you know, unless I'm absolutely forced to. But with this, you know, you kind of took a chance and did pulpy things because, you know, there was nothing to stop it, discourage you.
And in this, you had obviously so a luck pool, which sort of refreshed
exactly,
each session. Yeah, and every time you spent luck, it's as though basically you got two successes, three successes.
Yeah, so, and that gave you more momentum, which again encouraged you to, you know, so I think it for me, it was a really kind of pulpy.
Yeah.
Pulpy system, and I thought that really suited the book. Well, you know? Well.
The thing is, I do like the way that the 2D20 system works with each of their games. I do think that, like with Star Trek, which I have run a fair amount of, and Conan, which I have run a few sessions of, and playing this, I think they do change it to fit. I mean, I don't know if anyone else has ever read the John Carter book.
I have.
Yes, I love it. And I actually do feel that they have changed the rule set so that it actually feels like you are playing something that Burroughs could have written. It's just done in such a way that, you know, people don't really fail in those books. No. You only fail briefly to have a little cliffhanger until the next chapter. That you don't fail. You never sort of like die, as it were. You know, that you're always brought back and you can always, you know, spend that luck or think of another way around, jump on the airship rather than climbing up a rope. There's always something you can do. And also when in Star Trek, again, it fits that system so much better. You are going to have specialists because you've been trained by Starfleet. You will have more bennies in doing certain bits and pieces. And again, the momentum system there works in a similar way that you can succeed. You're more likely to succeed in something that you would be trained in. And Conan, again, it fits the style of Howard's book. My only issue is they do change it so much that you can't go from one game to another and go, I know how this runs, because you will fall flat on your face, because it doesn't quite run that way. The changes are enough. You can't automatically easily switch.
Yeah.
And if you walk in from this game and walk into playing a Star Trek game thinking, yeah, okay, your poor officer's going to die. It's going to be lasered to death by something. You might as well just put the red shirt on before you walk out the door. But all in all, yeah, the 2D20 system, I do have my reservations about it every so often, but they do a great job of getting it to fit. I've not played one of their games yet where I thought, really, guys, you should have picked a difference.
Yeah.
Because it does work. And they do put a lot of time and effort into that, but you can't easily switch between them.
Arguably, Conan is also pulp. Books certainly are. It's certainly, you know, a muscle-bound, bloke who's hard as woodpecker lips, like crushing the jeweled throwing beneath his sandaled feet and all that. But
in Conan, you may not be playing a barbarian. You could be playing one of the many other classes of people there, and you may be the sneaky backstabbing git who would steal the jewel from you while you sleep. So it doesn't quite have that same feel to it, but it does work really well. I mean, if you like Howard's books, I think Conan works very well for that.
Yeah, I think the thing with Conan is it's a much bigger world than the John Carter world. There's much more kind of expansion to it, so there's much more opportunity for different variations. You know, I mean, while there are a few John Carter books, essentially you've got just the types of Martian and obviously the Jazumians, you know.
So the later books, they do talk about sort of broadening out. So it talks about Venus, it talks about, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I think they are really nice books, beautiful. I mean, the artwork is fantastic. They've obviously taken a lot on it. I think, you know, it was a real labour of love for them, because I think, again, it was one of their early iterations of 2D20.
Kat and I actually did the play test because our friend Virginia was actually quite heavily involved in the production of John Carter when she was at Modiphius. So so we got to do some of the play testing,
That was quite early, wasn't it? So that's pre-Star Trek. I think it was 2D20, Mutant Chronicles was the first.
I'm trying to remember. It was either pre-Star Trek or just after. Mm. But Star Trek was just a sudden release because they didn't have permission to kickstart it. Basically, That just literally came out, most of their stuff obviously tends to be kickstarted. So
it really is staggering how Conan, when you play Conan, and I know we all have a kind of at a certain base knowledge for some of these things, but you drop into the way of doing it. And when we played John Carter, we dropped into playing it like John Carter. It, mm. it, it's this is what I say. I think that there is a little bit of magic in fact. Oh, and if you ever get around to playing Fallout 2D20 version, you'll spend a lot of time doing tedious inventory management.
Is that a core experience of the game?
It's the core experience of the video game, and they felt the need to transplant that into the role playing game.
Is that fun?
No.
Okay,
no,
fair enough. It's
not in the slightest.
It doesn't always work, then, is what we're saying.
The thing is with that, you know, somewhere there's a little designer going, if we don't put this in, people will say this is not Fallout.
That's the problem. True. Is it? Developing any IP, there's all you need to get so go so far with make sure it reflects the experience. So I mean, as I say, my experience of pulp was limited. So, you know, this is the first sort of proper pulpy game I've run. I quite liked it. I think it is a complete difference from, because there's so few skills in it, and really in it sort of rewards lots of creativity on behalf of the players, because you've got only a small number of attributes or traits or skills, whatever they call them, attributes in the game to sort of combine together. And I think as with any game where you're particularly good at a certain set of skills, so like in RuneQuest, if you're particularly good at fast talk, you'd always find a way to use fast talk. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's playing to your strengths, isn't it, really? But I think that sort of, it almost felt a little bit amplified in this, because again, you had a certain number of attributes that you could combine together. I liked traits. So that was really good. So then, you know, when they defined things like the Thark, so forearmed for war, you know, the fact they had four arms and they were like into battle, when they generated momentum, they got even more. So I think that they used the traits to sort of define the characters. It didn't mean that other characters couldn't have, obviously they couldn't grow four arms, but the rules are very permissive in terms of, you say, well, if you can find another way for this thing, mechanical thing, to happen for your character, you can do it. It almost feels like it's, if you're willing to put the work in, it can be a real toolkit. But yeah, and they did produce a lot of books, there's a whole lot of stuff. So there's far more than we ever looked at in our 13 sessions worth. But yeah, so it feels like we feel that the John Carter of Mars experience, and I think certainly having read the books, it felt like that, especially with Molly jumping around all over the place, bashing things up with her mighty fists, and Duraj Mad, so Mark's character, and Taran Tal arguing about who was the best swordsman. Well, there wasn't really an argument, was there? It wasn't
an argument.
the second best swordsman of Barsoom. So we played 13 sessions. What was the reflection on the game, on the series we played? I mean, did it feel like you were got into the Barsoomian way of doing things? How did it feel from your perspective?
I think it was surprisingly easy. Actually, I mean, I thought I'd read quite a lot of John Carter, and then you started saying things, and I go, I don't remember any of that. But,
warning, I may have been making stuff up.
Ah, okay.
As is usually the case.
Now I feel cheated.
No, that's right. No.
I think it was, I mean, you did a fine job of that, of actually just kind of setting it up. I was always very clear what the stakes were. I was always very clear who people were. And I was always very clear who needed attacking with a sword. And that was enough for me.
Put in the right direction, that's all you needed.
My own experience with John Carter is actually watching the film. I hadn't read any of the book. And yeah. I have to say, the campaign did feel quite cinematic. I could kind of see it being made into the second John Carter film, which would be great. Yeah. You know, so
I love the film. The film is so good.
The film is brilliant. It really should have. It's such a shame that it crashed so badly in cinemas. So I loved the film, and it gave me that film experience. It made me feel like I was playing a character in the film, and that was brilliant. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. It was certainly everything that I remember from the book. Without fail, when we finished the session, logged off the computers, I always had a smile on my face. It was always good fun. It was like those programs you used to watch when you were a kid, you know, the action programs you used to watch, you know, probably on a Saturday night when your parents were like, right, you can watch this and then off to bed. It just felt like that. It was great fun, and it, you know, I just felt that even though there was that very pared down sheet, we got so creative with it. And there were points where it was like, could we? Yeah, we can. That would be totally something my Martian would do, or, you know, my human would do, don't I? And it was brilliant. I just loved it. I thought it really did give a feel of the book.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, again, a setting that really repays engagement from the players. I think if you were to be a bit cautious or a bit over analytical about it, I think it probably wouldn't have. I mean, it was great fun, and it's always down to the people playing it, isn't it, really? But again, the people playing it need to be with the right mindset, which is, in this, is just go for it. So the system supported that. So you had your luck and you had your momentum. So it was, you were rewarded for really going at it. But yeah, I think you need to sort of have it with that sort of mindset, really.
I read the books a long time ago, like in school. Long time ago, and you know, it was one of those things that I got the PDF core book for free from Modiphius when they were like that. Hey, mm-hmm. who wants a free copy of John Carter from Mars?
Why not?
Yes,
I'll have that.
So when you were said, hey, you want to get me John Carter from Mars? I was like, yes, I'm in. So I immediately watched the film to get back into.
Yeah.
And I like, as Kat will attest from the Masks game, I like stuff that's over the top, full blown craziness. Because I'm not an apology to all of the World of Darkness players, but that is not for me. I am not.
You've never played World of Darkness with me.
it's all a bit too Anne Rice, Stephanie Meyer for me.
Oh, we had drag queens in our game.
It's terrible. I'm a monster, but I'm also a cube. No, and what I want is over the top, just crazy. And why I love PBTA. Sorry, Fabio. This game was, I loved it because I was like, yes, let's the finale where we Ming the Merciless, the bad guy with a starship. What's better? Well, with one of the airships. What's better? It's a better ending than that.
That was perfect. And I think I said on there when we were playing, I'd sort of set up a final combat, but then I thought, actually, that's a much better place to end it than grinding through another combat. So with the bad guy with his, you know, his twin heads, you know, this crazy, was it Duke was the giant, but Pew Mogul, who was the crazed, you know, and you just pinned the airship crashed through, Spike pinned him to the deck. I thought, do you know what? That's a perfect place to leave it. We don't need to go any further.
We charged headlong into that. Crazy kind of, there's a giant attacking like helium with white possessed white apes on the back of giant flying things, and we headlong into it, and Andrew was like, that I'm gonna ram him and spear him with my ship. We're like that, yes.
Let's do it. Yeah,
that was the Green Martian's viewpoint. Your Green Martian's viewpoint was, no, let me off.
Let me off this terrible flying thing.
Stay on the ground.
It's unnatural. I think we just about got to the point where, because again, there's a lot of flexibility in the rules. I know, Kat, that Molly had a pet banth, so like this huge sort of six-legged lion-type creature. And
it's,
I think...
tiny. I got a cob that was growing worse as I went along. I have to say, it would have been nice to get all the experience to have a full-size companion, but it was great fun just to have that little...
And that last session.
To be fair, that was an absolute XP sink. Ginger, which possibly stopped me from going for some other bits, which would have probably just gone absolutely gonzo, I think, with my character with like martial arts and stuff. So
it's only fair that Ginger the Banth got an outing right towards the end. But yeah, and I was just reflecting, so I mean, when we played, so we played Mine Merchants of Mars, which is sort of the intro game, and then the intent was to launch into Phantoms of Mars, which is a sort of campaign which they bundled up as part of the Kickstarter, which starts, you know, a little with essentially somebody gets kidnapped and they go to the dead city of Korvas. And then, because often I start running these games and I haven't read the whole scenario. Mission, right?
So, what an admission, Steve.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, some would say that I start these games and never read the rules either. So, make us go along.
You're talking about playing PBTA. that's how you play it.
Anyway, so we were playing the game. It's going fun. We were, enjoying it. There was combat. You know, there was ever any threat of any of the characters dying, because that's just not pulp. But anyway, there's lots of fighting going on. And then I thought I better read the rest of this campaign. I read the rest of the campaign, and I thought, do you know what? Because what happens in the campaign, as written, right, is you get accused of, you return to Helium after rescuing the scientists, and you get accused of treason. Okay, and then according to this campaign, you spend about the rest of however long you play going from city to city, getting people to be on your side, and then coming back to city to prove your freedom. And I thought, that sounds so dull. I mean, to me, that's, I thought, do you know what, that's a travelogue round Barsoom just feels dull. So I read
like the books either, really.
Huh? Exactly. So I read a story, one of the last stories written. And it's called The Giant of Mars. So all that mad shit about people having their heads removed, brains removed, and like shoved into the white apes was me. That I made that up. Fair enough. Okay. But that thing about the giant with the, you know, the sort of thing on and the P mogul, all that mad stuff going on. That was pure John Carter. So that was me going, do you know what? If we play this, this is going to go on forever and it's going to be really boring. So that's when we went down that crazy route of insanity. But there you go. Admission from me. Read the scenario before you play it.
Well, it sounds to me that not reading it was probably actually quite a good idea. Because, yes, that's not even worth.
I know. Yeah, it was disappointing.
To be honest, I'm not sure how the rules I've written would support a kind of travel log, kind of trial debate thing anyway, really. I mean, as we said, it is kind of. The rules are really kind of pulpy, aren't they? So
yeah, I wanted action. You know, that's what I wanted to see in it.
Well, that's what you expect, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, lots of jumping around and stuff. Yeah. So anyway, so there you go. So you didn't play Phantasm of Mars apart from the first couple of sessions. Then I was reading the sort of John Carter stuff, and I was so taken with people having their tops of their heads taken off and having their brains implanted in white apes and stuff. I thought we're doing that instead.
it was an excellent choice.
It's good fun. It's good fun all the same. Absolutely. All right. Okay. So it feels like John Carter of Mars, we enjoyed it. It was good fun. I think it's probably not my preferred style of game in as much as it's, you could do it and it's quite good fun, but I think it's, you know, use it as a palate cleanser for me personally. I mean, it sounds like you, Jim, you probably play those sort of games all the time. That's your preferred mode of action. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm prepping Rifts Savage Worlds at the moment, and that is going to be, I mean, Rifts is insane. So this is going to be insane. So I'm looking forward to that one. But again, I think, you know, I have to go back to almost like take refuge in things like Against the Dark Master or things like that. That are a bit, you know, or MERP or Role Master every now and then. I can venture out into the wild lands of pulp game, but I need to go back where there's a bit of threat and misery. That's all right. That's my happy home.
there's always time for freeform jazz. I mean, this is
No one needs jazz.
I love John Carter because it appealed to my. I really like heroic games. I have to retreat back into sort of at least semi-simulationist. You know, I do kind of like having lots of skills to pick from, and you know,
and chance of losing your left leg.
So exactly, two hour combats. And
I enjoyed John Carter. I would say it's definitely a palate cleanser in between all of my Vampire the Masquerade sessions. Thank you, Jim. It gives a totally different thing from what I normally end up playing a lot of. And, you know, bear in mind all of this was going on, but obviously I do a lot of playtesting for reviewing for the magazine. Mm. So it's so nice to have something that is pick up and just go for it. For me, my happy place would probably be more with Vampire. there is definitely space in this for me, because I just love the sheer nature of being able to go out there and what shall I do now? Shall I spend 2 hours politicking around it, or shall I just punch him? I'm going to punch him.
Punch him.
That's any game where you can adopt an animal as a winner, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I love Ginger. I don't think everyone else loved Ginger, but I love Ginger.
You're very happy with Ginger. All right, on that bombshell. Yeah, thanks very much for playing, John Carter. It was great fun as always. And look forward to playing again sometime soon. See you later.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
So I don't anticipate that we're going to be spending ages on this, but I just thought it'd be good just to sort of get our thoughts down, because I think this is probably one of the games that has vexed us more than any other that we've played, I think. And I'm fully prepared to accept that it's a me problem, or maybe an us problem, rather than a game. Maybe a game doesn't necessarily suit us, in the spirit of being open, whatever. Sam's going now.
It takes someone with a very specific set of skills to play this game. And run it. Well, I don't think I'm one of those people.
So I thought we'd probably just start off. And we'll start with, you know, good stuff, first of all. Because I think we've all got varying histories with the game. Because I think, Kat, you played it when it was back in playtest, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Back in RP Haven when Freddie was first starting out doing this.
So how long ago is that then? Because I know it was like, it went to the Kickstarter. So Martin kickstarted it.
Quite a long time ago. No, it was a really long time ago because it was like the first venue that Stratford was at.
And so, I mean, every FGM, every play group is different. But I just wondering whether the experience that we had, was that similar to the one you had before, or was it sort of quite different? Because obviously Freddie was he was all in his mind.
I think very different. With Freddie, obviously, it's his world, so he knew the rules or what he wanted inside out. Yeah. Steve, who was one of the playtest GMs, again, because he'd played it with Freddie, I think he'd learned it from there. So it was very different because they kind of had an idea of what they wanted to achieve with it. Yeah, it's a bit different to somebody coming cold from it, I think.
So, yeah, well, we'll come to the experience of playing it whole from the printed page. But yeah, I can imagine it probably would have been quite different. And Martin, I think you kickstarted it, didn't you, Martin?
I did indeed. Why?
No. Well, okay. So the reason that it attracted me was it just looked amazing. I mean, the presentation of the book itself is great. I mean, the artwork is incredible. It pitches like an air of mystery to it. And it is a hard sci-fi setting as it's pitched. What was it that sort of pulled you into it, Martin, when you were...
The look of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it is beautiful. Mm. And I think the way it was sold was a sort of like part of that Kickstarter kind of presentation. Your characters will develop as they recover lost memory. Mm. And that's great. I mean, really, that was a real hook for me. I thought, that's interesting. That's really good. And you'd start off with basically a blank page and your character would develop as you play.
So there's no character creation as such. I mean, you choose the type of vagabond, amnesiac, the person in the game that's forgotten who they are and what they're doing.
And that to me was really intriguing. Mm. So that kind of set a little hair run. And as I remember, it was quite a reasonable Kickstarter as well. It wasn't one of the like, eye-wateringly... here's all the add-ons. It was just a nice, simple Kickstarter. This, get the book, and so that's appealing too. I mean, on a purely kind of prosaic level. But yeah, I mean, that was it. I think it was the art plus the kind of the hook of this whole recovered memory thing.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, one of the things that sort of prompted me to get it and to run it was you saying, I have no idea how to run this. Having read it, I've got no idea how to run it, and I went, okay, let's give it a go and see if we can work it out.
And there's the difference between you and I, Steve, right there. You saw it as a challenge. I saw it as something that would look pretty on my shelf. But yeah, it's that. And that, I think that was the thing. I mean, I gave it, giving it a read through, and obviously I'm getting old. My attention span, my willingness to deal with really complicated stuff. But reading it on a run through, it was like trying to hold jelly. You kind of thought you had, you see what he's getting at, And then you gave it a bit more of a read. No, I've gone. He's lost me.
It's like reading The Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. Yeah. You're okay to page 3.
Yeah. And I found that quite a frustrating experience because, like, and I know I've used this expression before, and in fact, I use this expression quite a lot. But, you know, Freddie, is it? Sorry.
We're saying like that, we know who he is. Yeah. Only Kat has actually met the guy. So, you know.
That kind of purity of vision, you know, you've got to admire that. But clearly, in his own head, this all fits together perfectly and there's all logical links, all this kind of steeped in kind of canon. But when you're trying to come at it from like kind of gaming angle, I mean...
Let's come to that in a bit, because I think, I mean, where we are now is that it intrigued you. Hmm. It intrigued me. Sam, I mean, you sort of came on board after I said, we're going to give it a shot and see what it was like. I mean, what was your first impression just of the game, of the sort of the setting? What was it that made you go, I'm going to commit some of my time to this idiot Steve who's going to run it and see what happens?
I think it's the look of the book. The book does look gorgeous to start with. And the idea that you're playing a science fiction game, which I do like, and you're finding your own memories. I mean, it requires a lot of creativity, I have to say that. And I thought, not usually my type of game. Maybe I'll give it a go, see how it goes. And I did enjoy it.
Creativity was we enjoyed it. I think, we'll give our sort of sense at the end of if we were going to run it again or play it again, what would we do differently with it, if we were going to do anything differently. But it was, I think it was, it was intriguing, wasn't it? It looked mysterious. What about you, Kat? I mean, obviously you came back to it, so obviously there's a sense that you wanted to give it another try or do something with it. What were your thoughts?
Well, as per everybody's, it looks gorgeous. I mean, there was a lot of time spent on the whole thing being very cohesive all the way through. I mean, considering when it was actually kickstarted. I would say free league standard, you know, it's that high. For me, I love the idea of a sci-fi setting where you are not going to be bogged down with everything straight away. You don't play a member of the Covenant. You don't play anyone who's been around. You're playing someone who's in, who has no memories. So I love that idea that you're not going to have a mix in the group of somebody who goes, I know exactly what's going on. None of you do. And I just like the way that you have to build your characters up as you go. And it's something that the games say you can do and never do. But this game is hinged on it.
Which, in many ways, that's almost like the perfect pitch, isn't it? So simple system, and we'll get to the system in a second. It's, you know, as long as you like sci-fi, a bit of mystery. Character creation is the work of, well, a few minutes. Like if you read a bit of an idea of what the different character types are. You know, it's the whole thing about, well, why is Earth Dawn so brilliant? Because, which obviously it is, but why is Earth Dawn so brilliant? Because you sort of come out of essentially a nuclear shelter after this, you know, this terrible apocalypse, and the world has changed. So nobody knows what's going on. And so, you know, as you, as the players and the person running it, yes, you know, there's a framework, but you're essentially, you're working it out together, aren't you? That's the, and then, which is to me, seems brilliant. Probably, you know, a bit challenging maybe for a one shot, but I think there's, you could make a case for running it as a one shot as well as a series. So we came into it, I think, high hopes. Let's go. Let's say that we were intrigued. We were giving it a go. And I suppose just to sort of, you know, the, as you said, Martin, the pitch is it's a science fiction game. You're on a space station, although the player characters don't necessarily don't know that. All they know is they're in this world that has no skies. There's a lot of a little bit of gloss. It's not Sky Realms of Jeroen levels of words to want to know, but there's a little bit of like an Assyrian background to it. There are things.
Oh, I disagree, Steve. The lexicon at the beginning is huge confusing.
I would totally agree with Sam.
Okay.
I think it was gnarly point of like almost willful obscurantism.
You think? Perhaps because I've been reading Sky Realms of Jeroen, and that is the nth degree of obscurantism. So maybe, I suppose it's all relative, isn't it, really? But I quite like the idea that there's, you know, different. So, for example, you're on this space station, which is, you know, centripetal force. Well, no, whatever. Anyway, so basically, centrifugal, whatever. So it means the further you go out from the centre, the heavier gravity is. They've got this thing called the world's punishment, and they call it Kabadu, which is this, you know, the gravity pushing down on you. I mean, if there was enough there to make it hooks to make the world feel a bit different. Admittedly, trying to introduce that quite quickly would be a nightmare, I think. So, you know, and I suppose, interestingly, what that felt like, because I think, Sam, you'd read it. Obviously, you played before Kat and Martin, you'd had a look at it. I mean, how did that feel sort of starting to get introduced to the world as we started playing? Was it a real info overload, or was it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
It would have been really helpful to have had some images of what the environment we're in was actually like, because I just think a place with no sky inside the space station, I could not visualize what we were supposed to be looking at. But having looked at some of the pictures from the actual book, there are some really open environments and weird city shapes and things like that, which would have been quite useful to have right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Just to give me an idea of what we were doing.
I was going to say yes and no. I get Sam's point, definitely. But also, it's really weird because the way it gets described when you, particularly, because I think you were running the module, weren't you? So as you do the descriptions, it kind of fills it in enough, but not enough, if that makes sense. You have to go and look, which I kind of like, because I really hate it when it's too laid out, because everyone's like going, I will go to that doorway.
So it's very open. I mean, when we were playing, you were starting right on the fringe of what they call the umbra, so right on the edge, you know, of where gravity is becoming a thing. And we'll come to sort of, you know, gravity and whatever in a second. But I think the idea is that you are starting in very constrained spaces. So there are a few images of like corridors and things like that, but they're not, because it's actually lots of artwork of corridors would be really boring, but equally would be really helpful. So. Yeah. You know, I dropped an image in there at the start of like the triangular corridors. But then, as you say, you know, then you get images of cities, but I sort of tried to drip that in a little bit as you go. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, you know, it is so alien that.
Yeah, I think, as you know, like for science fiction game, I do like the wow factor. And I think this has the wow factor. You have to kind of hack through quite a bit of jungle, as it were, sort of verbal jungle, to get to the wow factor. They're going to go, wow, this is like...
Do you think we ever got to the wow factor?
Well, I think sometimes, we kind of like, for example, like the kind of idea, when you're describing Nataku, the
yeah,
the giant water wheel, and you know that I was feeling that. I was feeling that like something, like, you know, you could see Ian Bank writing something where there was that kind of big idea, big concept, high concept sci-fi, which I would say, because I disagree, Steve. I don't think it's that hard sci-fi. It's got hard sci-fi elements, but it's high concept sci-fi. Mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. But I think you did get the wow factor. I definitely did, and I think some of the art really helped with that. But in your head, in my head anyway, it was hard to see how it all fitted together.
Yeah.
So it'd be like, wow, look at this. It's settled. Maze. Really interesting. Oh, and look, here's an underground a lake. And you're having to do quite a bit of suspension of disbelief. Like I said, what the hell's a giant lake doing on a space? So there is a bit of that. So you got the wow factor. But if you looked at it for too long, you thought, hang on a second, what's going on?
And that's not explained. I mean, I think, you know, again, the designers left it open because it, no one explains why the people are on the space station.
Yeah.
There's a sort of implication that some ancient Assyrian race got snatched up for some reason. So I think there's leaving it open, which is great because you can then, you know, come to your own reason why. But because there's no explanation, you've got nothing, it's nothing to ground it in, if you know what I mean. You don't know if you're doing it right, whatever right might be.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah. I was never sure where what doing was like. Right.
No,
are we fitting into this world properly?
Yeah.
And I think that was good. That was like, sorry, that feeling I did. Steve, I'm just going to read. Here you go. Just for the listeners at home. The Archaean Sorrow. The waters that gifted Nataku with the power they sought for cursed the locale known today as the Archaean Sorrow. Once news of success reached Antumbra, the Council of Chachamesh made a bold move. They set out to create a small community. Hopeful with Nakatu's assistance, they forge a foothold. Now, that would be good if the next paragraph was then broke that down into what that was saying. But the next paragraph is equally as kind of information dense.
Yeah.
And explanation light. And I think that to me was why, like, when I'm trying to read it and picture it and kind of that. But I mean, it's lovely.
Yeah.
It's absolutely lovely. And it's got a real, like I say, a vision, but unwieldy for using, I think.
So Kat, and again, I'm going to lean on you quite a bit here. What would you have, having seen it before, what would you have done differently? I think, because I think there's a solid gaming experience in there.
Yeah, I think with what Martin was saying, I think there's a big thing with like RuneQuest fans, you know, your grind for may vary. Mm. And I think definitely here your Nibiru will vary. It's left. There's enough detail in there that you could chase something down and make it official. She puts some little quotation mark. But the point is, it's I think that it's to be your own, because if you're running a dark, which is it's sometimes quite a horrific body horror sci-fi setting. If you're going to read that blankly out of a book or something you've seen online, it's not going to have the same impact. I think Nibiru provides a framework for the GM and the players to hang things onto and create their own.
It is very much a storytelling game, isn't it? If we think storytelling is being quite narratively driven and you know, character driven, that sort of thing. Yeah. But yeah, okay. So there's a world in any role playing game. Essentially the rules are what enable you to interact with the world, investigate and create, you know, what that world means for your characters. So the rules are there. The rules in the beer are extremely light. So essentially you don't stop with any skills at all. Okay. You don't start off with any ability in anything. Essentially everybody gets to roll 3d4. For anything they try and do. I'm explaining this to the listeners at home. You guys know. 3d4, anything you do. And then if any of those come up for 4, this is for a general skill roll, then you've succeeded. Sometimes you might get an extra dice. So, for example, you create memories, which mean you... I mean, I think, Sam, one of your character's memories was... Give me an example of one of your memories and what you were... What a bonus that gave you.
I can't remember, but there were some really horrible things I thought about. Because my background was I had to create memories that were memories from an animal's point of view.
That's right.
So, you know, I was escaping the nest while somebody came and ate all of my young, which gave me a reduced empathy, for example.
Yeah. So you could have memories which were negative memories, which meant you were less good at doing things. So -1, -2, fewer dice. Or you could have a memory which made you better at doing things. So you might be rolling 3 or 4 dice and then, you know, you had a greater chance of rolling a 4. But then combat was slightly different, because then what you did, if it was close combat, again, it was you roll the dice and you added them up. And then the more that if you got greater than the opponents, if you doubled the opponent's roll, then you did more damage. Blah, blah, blah. And then, but if you shot somebody, it went back to the just the D4 roll. So I think it's extremely loose. So and I probably explained it really poorly, but I think that's pretty much what we were doing. Did it model what we think the game was trying to be, really?
For me, yeah.
Okay.
Because it is a storytelling system, I think it works well. The combat was, be fair, short and nasty, which...
It's very deadly.
I kind of want, and very brutal, which I do want in a sci-fi setting. I don't want it to go on forever and a day. And also, I think with a storytelling system, if combat goes on too long, you lose the story.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it worked. I can see there will be a lot of players who would hate it, particularly if you lose a character in like a couple of roles. You would probably be quite annoyed.
But the fact that the character didn't even need to roll with it up. You just pick a type of amnesiac, one of these, you know, individuals that have forgotten everything about it. You just pick a type, that's it, and just go, and you can start playing straight away. Admittedly, you know, you'd want to build them into the story, but mechanically it's very straightforward.
I quite like the dice rolling system.
Yeah.
And how that worked, yeah, with the bonuses and negatives as well. I'm not sure combat was just too brutal for my liking, for a little bit of hero, especially if you've got an experienced character, you can just die like that. Yeah. I didn't like that. But the skills, the memory system, I found really quite nasty. Because you could easily metagame it, which I did, I think you find. I ended up the game with 9 skills, all of which were 7 positive, 2 negative, because I worked out how I was going to do things. And I thought, yeah, this, I could work this here. I could take a disadvantage here. I could get an advantage here. You know, it's easy to do. And I thought the skills, it didn't give you any sort of advantages there. Because the skill names were obviously going to make your own skills, don't you? They're not.
There are no skills in the game. So, for example, it might be investigating, running away, you know, which is, again, you're creating it on the fly.
You've got to spend your points carefully, because you cannot have something that's too broad, like fighting skill, for example. You couldn't do that. But then again, you don't want to waste your points on something that's too narrow, like
botany.
For example.
That was a false gospel, botany.
Yeah, and the thing about those, the GM has an awful lot of extra work to do on top of what the GM's already doing with working out how those skills work, giving those skills out, all that sort of stuff.
Or the revelation when you tried to get Steve to do all of that for you?
Yes, my character had a thing called the synapse event, which means it could call on the Leviathan, who was, I don't know what it was.
So each type of amnesiac had got like a special ability they could do. So for example, Sam, your character, as you say, they were from an animal background or whatever. I mean, in my head, I was thinking that it was almost like the space station itself was creating you vagabonds and sort of implanting these memories in you to try and, I don't know why it was doing it, but anyway, it was that's what I thought was happening. I thought we might find that as well.
So the point was, my character could do something which allowed you, Steve, as the GM, to take over control of what my character did, which is, why would you ever want to do that, honestly?
And I think that's one of the things that comes through in this game, is that a lot of it, as you said, that I think the people who created it got a very strong idea of what it is and what it was, and also what the story should be. So there's a lot of, although there's a lot of freedom for player characters to do what they liked, I think actually there was a lot on the GM, or a lot of power that could be ceded to the GM to tell a story alongside the player. So, and I think if you're more about, for me as a GM, I feel more comfortable saying, right, here's a situation, here's a, you know, set of things and just go off and do it, as opposed to, right, I'm going to take your characters off you and then all your narrative control is taken away. You're going to do this way. And frankly, I didn't want to create that. I didn't want to, that wasn't where I wanted to be with it.
You handed it straight back to me.
I did. I said, no, Sam, I'm not doing that. So yeah. you tell me what it is.
I'm going to disagree with Sam a little bit, because I think that, I mean, obviously...
No change
Sam,
there.
Yeah. I think Sam was, I think... Part of Sam was you were testing the system, weren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that you had a deliberate kind of project. See how that worked. Whereas, I mean, I just took the whole sort of, you know, storytelling-y thing, and I quite liked that because generally I do when I've got a chance to influence my character by fitting in bits of narrative. I like that, and so I kind of enjoyed that. But what I thought, just some of it was just so counterintuitive. It's like, fail at this, you know, automatically fail, then get a point for this, and then you can spend that to succeed. And that kind of did my head in a little bit.
I mean, I get that. I mean, that was quite good in as much as you, so you had memory points. So memory points are what you could spend to buy, you know, X positive memories, or, you know, to, which gave you more dice to do particular things. So, for example, fighting, or you could say, actually, I'm going to voluntarily fail at something. So, and you'd always be bad at that or less good at that in future. So you got, so there was a playoff there. So I think, you know, if you were trying to game the system, you could, and, you know, Reds used to do it. So
I think it took me a while to get my head around the fact that, like, it's a way of shaping your character. You make them bad at some things, and then automatically they'll become better at others. And so, I don't know, just to put it in, like, really crude terms, if you wanted a thief, for example, you would start, you deliberately fail all the physical stuff, but then you would use those memory points to improve your stealthy stuff, your thiefy stuff. And I know that's not how the system works or anything.
No.
I'm just trying to give, like, a sort of simple example. And that's how your character started to recover their memories. So they remembered they were really bad at fight, but they remembered they were really good at picking lock as they went along. And I kind of liked that, and I could narrow that in, and that my character's kind of special power was just indecipherable. I thought not so much the power itself, the kind of the song of the lost machine, but how that worked mechanically. Every page you had a first foundation and a last revelation, and oh man, that was hard. That was hard going.
I think of all the, so we had four types of amnesiacs. So we had, you know, your character, Martin, who was a vagabond of the machine. So used to be an AI, but had been reborn somehow in this fleshy body.
It's unclear.
We had, and again, your special ability was odd, I think it's fair to say, you know, relied on the mechanics of the game, which were a little bit, you know, loosey-goosey, let's say. As you say, Sam, your special ability, you were an animal that had been reborn in a human body, and you got this thing called the Leviathan, which was there to protect you. Again, bit odd as to how that would work. Then we had Howard, who was also playing Latix Exile on Twitter, and he never got to grips with his. He had a bright towner, so they were somebody from a nice setting that had been reborn in this weird Scarlet World. And again, his ability was a bit strange. The most straightforward one was yours, Kat, which was the Dreadlander, okay, who had come from a world of utter horror and had brought that in the form of this weird symbiotic thing that lived inside you.
Yeah.
Which, well, tell us what happened. What would you do if you were threatened?
Well, if a Dreadlander's threatened, we have a nightmare that lives inside us. We were pretty much awoken into this world without a sky, and it's infinitely nicer than where we were. Even though it's horrible, this, you know, I've seen worse. But so I have a nightmare that lives inside me, which they do describe as almost like a gaseous type being when it comes out to start with. But on a D4 roll, literally, it will only not come out on a one. So it will always generally come out to defend the Dreadlander. It will obey a short command, but literally pouring out of your mouth. I think I described it as Samara from the Ring. Literally, this thing clawing out of somebody's mouth.
But essentially, it came out of you, your throat, and then murderized people. That's what it did. And then it went back in. And going back in was probably even worse than... But that was that was the most straightforward part. But then when you couldn't create any positive memories, and I could never work out, how is this supposed to work? I don't understand.
I think that's the counterbalance, because in one way, I think the Dreadlander is, in theory, quite powerful because the nightmare is so strong. And for any physical attacks, it gets four dice. And if I fill a page, it gets another dice. So increasing this thing just gets stronger but on the other hand, my Vagabond would get probably weaker because if I spend memory points, I can never get a positive memory.
Exactly.
I never get it with the rule of three, and I think one other way as well, which is rare. Literally, I end up with one positive memory out of 6 weeks.
Because you rolled three fours.
Yeah.
So then it gave you automatic positive memory.
Yeah. So. But everything else, you know, you could just see this in one way very powerful because you've got this nightmare, but your character's going to become very, very weak.
Yeah.
It's never going to have that. Also, I think mentally that character is always going to be on a downward spiral. So then, you know, it's quite
limited, I think it's fair to say.
It is quite limited. And also for me, I didn't bring out the nightmare for absolutely ages because I wanted it to be at a point where it would bring the most
horribleness to it.
Yeah.
So, and you touched on there about this. So we talked about creating memories, which are like your skills for your character, and everyone's, you know, different. But then I think you touched on, so on the character sheet, you have pages where you fill in memory. There are blanks and you fill the memories in. So I think once you've got, I can't remember exactly how many it is, but a number, once you fill a page, eight, okay, you fill a page, you're then entitled to have what they call a revelation. So it's almost like what would be a feat, I think, into other game systems. Really,
quite as powerful.
But again, when Sam, obviously, always eye on the main chance, looked at the revelations. What was your opinion of the revelations, Sam? I think
pointless was the word I'd use.
I think there was they probably had narrative weight.
Yes,
but again, a lot of it was ask your GM.
Yeah, it's getting the GM to do a lot of the heavy lifting. Yeah, and it's really a bit pointless. I mean, create something that you could do as a player, which gives you a slight bonus.
Yeah.
That's fine, but they weren't doing that. I mean, things like, what's this one? You can store memories in object. Why would you want to do that?
Well, I mean, again, it might be something that would be useful in a particular setting within a game, but I think it is. So yeah.
You have to ingest it to recover that memory. So don't store it in something big.
So in something tasty, like a hamburger or something, a kebab. But So I think the system on the surface is straightforward and it allows lots of narrative flow, etc. But I think so much of it is implied, and I think it comes back to what you were saying at the start, Martin. So this is the fruit of somebody's brilliant internal vision of what it was going to be like, this imagination, and also some great artists who created this fantastic art. But I think the actual realization on the page, I think there's, for me as a GM coming to it, there are so many gaps in there, the amount of work you have to do to make it feel like the world.
Yeah, vague is the one word that really covers the whole thing.
What I don't want to do is put people off having a go
at I think people should have a go at it, definitely, because I think it will give them it certainly gave me a really good experience in some ways, and just a different way of looking at character development. Really interesting. I think I disagree. So I think it's too simple to say it's too vague, because I would say that the problem is some bits are really vague and some bits are incredibly precise, and how those two things mesh together doesn't always seem to function. So for example, you know, we're talking about it being very narrative and so on, which is at heart, and you would think that gives you lots of freedom, but the environment is drawn so tight that it's like, well, I've got all these narrative options, and actually I think some bits are really, really some of what I'm trying to interact with is actually really laid out. Now I absolutely agree with what Kat says, you know, your Nibiru might vary. But it's a bit like Glorantha in that you can't start to make your Glorantha vary until you're kind of got grips with how it works, and then you can start to play. And I think with Nibiru, I didn't get to a position in my head where I felt like I played. Sam probably did, but I didn't. I think so. That would be my overarching thing. Would be some bits are too vague, some bits are too specific, and they didn't always kind of.
I think the specific bits are where it was that the author trying to got a really clear idea of what it should be and how he would run the game. And I think obviously GMs are different, and I think, you know, games tend, you need to be able to, it needs to be sort of so that anyone could get their hooks into it. And I think it takes a very specific type of GM and a specific set of players to really get the most out of this thing.
Absolutely, you need a specific set of players who are going to be highly creative and very wordy, I think, would be the ideal group. Not some barbarians who likes to go down and kill things. Never going to work.
Yeah, I do think that this system really would fly with a very tight-knit group who've probably played together for a while and know each other's thing. And then I think that would reduce the stress on the GM, because those players would automatically say, what about this? And then the GM doesn't have to do it. So I'd honestly say to anybody to give it a go. If you like the idea of storytelling games and narrative and telling a story where you've been in it and before and it's gone, well, yeah, but they've all said you can't do that. This system, chances are you will be able to give it a shot. Yeah. And it's currently, I think
it plays into the say yes GM. I think the closest I think the closest experience to this I've had with you, Steve, sir, is something like Heart, where there's lots of stuff and you have to kind of just create as you go along. And I mean, Heart's a bit more, the rules are a little more kind of clearly defined, mate.
Yeah.
But in terms of what the load on the players, mm-hmm. I think heart comes the closer.
And I think sort of the coming to being creative, and that some of that is written into the rules as well. So, for example, the players. So we talked about memories. So you're creating these memories and writing them down. When you get to the end of a page of memories. So it says things like, I can't recall, but the longer those memories are, so if they're like more than four lines, which is good because it's rewarding, you know, sort of granularity in terms of you describe what your character's background is, experience, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it requires and rewards that sort of side of things. So I think, you know, if someone was going to run it, okay, if someone's going to run it, play it, I think, you know, Kat, you already started to touch on, you know, be prepared. Know each other well, but be comfortable to play with each other, because there is some body horror elements in there. You can, you know, lines and vowels over that, but there's things that can happen which are a little bit unpleasant, I think it's fair to say. So you need to, you know, obviously have that trust with each other. I think in terms of rules, I would need to get, there's some bits I just need to rewrite, frankly, just to be able to make sense to me. So things like revelations, you'd need to go through and say, I just need to come up with something. I need to redo this because it didn't work for me. And I think
having a set skill list would be a huge advantage, because otherwise you're having to work around how you're going to fit this particular skill into this action you want to do. Mm. So, and then it gets really vague, especially when two people pick similar skills, not quite.
Yeah, so maybe you could because I think, you know, generally the year zero skill set or number seems to be about right. You know, people seem to be, when I was talking RuneQuest sets of skills here, we're talking, you know.
I'm going to disagree. Sorry.
Okay, no, go for it.
Because I think part of the charm of the game is you creating your own skills and seeing how you are developing. You know, you're developing as a character, so I think one of the strengths of the game is that mechanic. And one thing that's intriguing about it is that you recover memories as you go, which inform the skills that you get. So a skill list would defeat the object of what I think is one of the central planks of the game.
But don't you think that we as role players, we're used to skill lists? So we almost start to define our own. We've got our own expectations of what skills are and should be within a game. So you might say melee or shooting or whatever, or you might say. So it's almost like you're going to probably, if you've got different groups of players who have got similar backgrounds in our types of RPGs, you probably end up with quite a similar skill set to how long they've been playing for. I think that's
maybe,
what would happen.
Maybe, but I think, you know, you were so. I think the examples you're given in the tech are things like for my habitat. Sorry, not habitat.
Vagabond type. It is a habitat. Yeah,
habitat. You're right. So my habitat of the machine, you know, the examples it gave were like playing the piano, like super specific, and empathy. So it's kind of
very generic,
which is very generic. But part of the charm is like trying to, you know, get a nice balance between the kind of crazy specific, which might come in some point, and you're trying to weave them into your story, aren't you? So, you know, if I had plus one to playing the piano, you can bet your life I'd be saying, hello, so is there a piano in here?
And that would be really annoying.
Speak for yourself. Good for me. But, you know what I mean? It kind of influences then how you narratively kind of control your environment a little.
I was absolutely noticed, but I was definitely erring towards that. Let's make things a little bit more cohesive in terms of the skill type. So I probably wouldn't have. I'd have said, let's just make that music, shall we? Or maybe dexterity or something, you know, just a bit.
But maybe,
as I said at the start, I think that's probably a me problem.
You had enough. I think you had enough work to do as a GM as it is. So I think, you know, it was a natural way to try and simplify what you were doing. And I think,
because as a player, the memory points are so hard to come across that you really need to spend them as generically as you can. Otherwise, you're just going to be so specifically and not doing anything during the game.
Your free dice. You know, no matter what happens, you've got your free dice.
I think
with the skills and stuff, because you get to name them yourselves, you know, these aren't simple characters. You can, you can say I've got a background. I mean, how simple can you get? But you can now personalize that character more than any other game, almost, because you're personalizing it through memory. So you could have some generics, but it's quite fun to have the quirky ones as well. I think I do think that players need to balance them. So you don't want to be all quirky, because that's going to be unplayable. But it's quite nice to have a little quirk, like I play the piano. Hi, is there a piano in here? CM, no.
Yeah.
Jim, see if you can make one.
There are no pianos anywhere. Shut up.
How do I learn to play one then? How does this work? Oh, my word.
Well, that's a good question, isn't it, Steve? And one that only the AI could answer.
So I think, you know, you could go two ways. You could either go, let's, you know, have a predefined skills list, or, you know, but there's potential that actually not limited to that, just you can say actually go beyond it if you want to, but understanding that that's going, you're going in the quirky thing. So I think I'm almost, for me, like if I was advising somebody on how to, or if I was going to run it again, I'd probably do a bit of that, I think, sort of a bit of both, just to get a bit of the fun from both sides. I think, yeah, I would certainly, with things like the Vagabond types, I'd need to go through and almost like rewrite it again. I mean, I didn't, when I read it before, I thought, I'm not really sure this is going to work in play. Having played with you guys with them, with one of each type, one of each habitat, amnesiac type, I never really understood most of how it is supposed to work. You know, but again, I'm prepared to accept that's a me problem rather than. So I think that there's quite a bit of upfront development needs to be done for me to be comfortable. What about you guys? If you were advising somebody either running or playing, what do you reckon?
I would honestly recommend it needs to be a campaign. Mm. This doesn't work as a one shot in my experience. I know others will disagree, but I think you need to play it for at least four sessions to really get your head around it and start to then sort of run with it.
Mm.
Totally. No, I totally agree. I think this game only works as a campaign game. One shots, I mean, you do what I did and just metagame the hell out of it. It'd probably take you
3 hours to realise that that's what you could do, unless you were completely brilliant at, used to playing board games, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, but if you could expand it into a big campaign, you'd have a lot more time. A lot more things to work with, which would be ideal, really.
And I think you could, if you did a campaign as the draw out the theme out, because I think the other thing is about setting. Yeah, it's chock full.
So much
different
in there.
Themes, different ideas, places, creatures, different. Just mad. So I think if you've got a campaign and you can actually say, well, you know what, I'm going to dip, like 90% of this can go. I'm just going to focus on this element of the kind of overarching environment. So I'd say, like, as books, well, what would you say, 95% of the books is background?
5%? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's flavour, background. It's what makes you want to play, you know.
Yeah. But I think there's so much that you really need to think, like, what do I want to get out of this story and do it that way. In terms of like memories, skills, that way, like you're saying, like, it's too often you have like a skill list, or you can, as the GM, I think it's about having a dialogue, isn't it? So I think there's a middle way there, which is you know, you as GM,
once someone's created a skill in a game, then other people are going to ride on that same skill, aren't they?
Well, that's what I was doing. I was actually, as you were creating skills, I was writing them down. And that's then became a, you know, a thing that we rolled against. But in my head, because I've got this conceptual framework which is based around different types of skills, it's almost like I was genericizing it. But that loses some of the flavour that.
But yeah, should we have been doing that? Should we have just been having our own specific skill and then weaving that into the narrative of the game?
Could be.
I think there's an argument for both ways with that. I mean, saying generic like run. I mean, everyone can have that. But say, I don't know, something to do with animals or like creatures, that would probably be a very specific thing to your character, Sam, because the rest of us would go, is that going to try and eat our face? Or is you're more likely to go up to it.
Yeah, on Nibiru, probably would try and eat your face, because most animals were pretty dangerous, I think, overall. So, yeah, especially the mermaids, which is one of the creepier creatures I've ever come across. So that's, this weird sort of lobster-type creature that would grab onto corpses of people and make them wave for help.
Yeah, so it's great. Like,
it's weird. I mean,
no, but it's that's the thing, is it? The kind of the imagination.
Absolutely,
that powers this as a setting. I mean, if somebody said to me, I'm going to kickstart an anime of Nibiru, I'd be in.
Or a novel, maybe.
Or a novel, you know, I'd absolutely. Yeah. I'm just not entirely sure that were 100% as a role.
And we ran. So we played, I think it's 5 or 6 sessions of it. So probably, you know, just enough. Yeah. But I mean, we could have probably, you know, but I think we'd run out of steam with it by that time. We thought, do you know what? There's just so much work that I would need to do to be comfortable really going with it. So as I say, rewriting Revelations just for me to be able to be comfortable. I mean, you know, it's not a criticism of the game itself, but you know, so, okay. In summary, cause we've gone on about it a little bit. I think I would encourage people to have a look at it, definitely, just because it is beautiful. I think there's a lot of fantastic ideas in there. I think it is interesting in terms of how it deals with characters. I think that there are, as a GM, you need to be things to be aware of some of the, and read it thoroughly. And there's, you need to invest quite a bit of time in reading it, because there's a lot going on in there to get your head into, you know, what the whole world's about. Just from you guys, just one sentence from each of you. So, Kat, what was your sort of one point?
Oh, I just want to say, because one of the things you sort of mentioned about is could you use another system in this setting? So could you just say, right, like finding some of the system is a bit not quite working, but I love the setting. Could you kitbash it?
I think you need some mechanism whereby what you had was like a pool of points that you then invested into things, and I think saying actually, you know, I'm not as good with this particular skill. So if you're using the BRP, you could say, okay, you start with 100 points. And then as you go along, every skill starts at 20%, let's say. I don't know what the average of, you know, what the probability of rolling a 4 on 4d3, anyway, whatever. So you could do it that way. And then you say, actually, I'm going to be even worse at this. So, but I don't know. It would be equally as...
Lose all of the magic of the memories, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that was my view. So, it's a question you raised as something we could talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's right. I think that's the issue, is that because the character development is so unique, I don't think it back is as brilliant as the setting. Mm. I'm sure there's a way of doing it, like completely divorcing the setting from the character. Well, but then you're going to lose, I think, part of
what... run Savage Worlds, but that's not what it is. It's not game, is it? Yeah. So
I would say, sorry, Kat, just to say, like, if I was advising somebody running it, I would say, don't try and kitbash. Mm. I don't think... You might sit there, be thinking there, listen, I could probably, you know, work this D&D font. And I say, no, because then you're going to lose actually what is at the heart of...
You play D&D 5e in the Nibiru world, which is not what it's about, is it, really?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Sorry, Kat, what were you going to say?
I was going to say the only system that I think you could, but you'd need to hack that system a bit as well, would probably be powered by the apocalypse because of the playbook thing.
Okay.
But have negative, like have it when you're setting it up, that you have negatives as well as positives. To get bigger positives, you have to say the negatives. But even then, you'd have to hack that quite a bit, but that's about the only one I think might have that. But why? Because the system's so simple anyway. I mean, you can just do what every GM has ever done since dawn of time and house rule.
Yeah, there's a level of house ruling that you are comfortable with, then eventually you start to rewrite stuff, don't you? So house ruling's fine, rewriting things on the fly is a bit more challenging, but okay, all right. Anyone else got any final thoughts in terms of, yeah, give it a try, but be aware of X? I think we've talked it through quite a lot.
Well, I enjoyed playing it once I worked out what I was going to do with my character. Mm. I think it expanded my abilities as a player. Mm. I have to say, not very far, though. I'd never attempt to run this game.
Growth is growth.
Yeah. I haven't got the creativity to GM this game. I don't think I'd ever want to play it again, but I think everybody should give it a go.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really... really valid point. Probably a good one to end on, unless anyone else has got, they want to chuck in there, and I'll put Sam's at the end and I'll edit it.
I would only say lean into the memory system straight away. Don't think, oh, I'll wait and see how it plays. Seriously, just get started with it.
Yeah.
Once you get started with it, just carry on, because the system is built for the memories. Lean into it straight away.
Rolling five dice is incredibly useful if you're trying to get a set of three, four.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's worth getting good positive memories.
Yeah. Any final thoughts there, Martin?
No. Yeah, I think we're broad in agreement, I guess. I think it's intriguing. Its background is outstanding. It's a work of love that I think, and we should just respect that.
Absolutely.
And you know, I've got my issues with it, but I'm glad I've played it.
Yeah.
I would probably love to try and write, but I don't. That would be like...
If anyone could do it, Martin, you could do it with your attention to detail.
Oh, I focus. Don't think so. I think that's what... But I think I'd love to write something for it, but yeah, a heroic task. And I don't think I'm going to do that.
But meanwhile, it continues. It sits there, continues to look brilliant on my bookshelf, and I'm quite happy as far as that goes. So you can't ask for more than that, can you, really?
I just hope somebody somewhere is taking notice of what this guy is doing.
Yeah.
Because I think he's worth, like, investing time.
Yeah. Definitely. There's a real brain behind that, isn't there? And well, I don't know who did it. Was it a separate artist, Kat? I think it was. Did he do the art?
I think he was art coordinator, wasn't he?
Artists in for this one. I do know, I mean, if you've been followed on Facebook, more so than anywhere else, but for Zephyr, his next one, he's been doing a lot of the art for that. Because you've been doing the action replay, sort of like work in progress Wednesdays type thing.
Definitely a creative talent.
Yeah, massive.
It's worth noticing, if you look at the credit list, it's one of the few games I think I've seen with a mental health advisor.
Okay, all right.
And also an astrophysics advisor as well. And the Venn diagram of that is...
something to applaud, I think it's fair to say. All right. On that note, then, guys, thanks very much for the time again, as usual. All right. Thank you.
That was really good.
Yeah. My pleasure, as always. All right. Take it easy. Bro. See you soon. Cheers. All right. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to another exploration of my gaming vexes. If you've got any thoughts you'd like to add to what you've heard here, or a gaming vex of your own you'd like to offer up for discussion, you can get in touch with me on Blue Sky via at allanth.bsky.social or via Discord as allanth.vex. Until next time, may all of your games be free of vexatiousness and be excellent to each other always.